Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Dr. Jack Westman, who is the author of The Cancer Solution, Taking Charge of Your Life with Cancer. This is a cancer handbook for inquisitive laypersons and healthcare professionals. Dr. Westman is Professor Emeritus of Psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. And he is also the president of Wisconsin Cares, a nonprofit advocacy organization for families. And he's been president of three professional organizations. He's written over 150 professional publications and 12 books. That's quite a legacy there, Dr. Westman. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
So would you like to tell the listeners a little bit about how you got interested in the treatment of cancer and the actual investigation of what we need to be changing within the cancer communities and research communities in order to better serve the public?
Although I'm a psychiatrist, I am a physician, and my beloved wife, Nancy, had cancer, and I, like everyone else, simply was going along with the program that had been outlined for me and for her by our treating physicians, who were really fine people. And she passed away 3.5 years ago, and went through what is a typical course of dehumanizing, extremely painful demise. Mm-hmm. As a result of that, and with the occurrence of cancer and two other close relatives, I decided that I would devote full time, I'm actually retired from clinical practice, to the study of the history, the present state, and the future of cancer. So I devoted 2.5 years full time to researching these topics, and in the process learned an immense amount myself, but also became very discouraged in terms of the state of the cancer field today. I believe there's a reasonable possibility that if I had known 5 years ago what I know today, my wife might still be living. Now, the first point I'd like to make is that cancer in itself is not a disease. Cancer cells are the products of the disease neoplasia, just like a high blood sugar is the product of diabetes. So this means, then, that any kind of treatment that simply is devoted to identifying and killing cancer cells, although necessary, is not enough, that the treatment needs to also be devoted to the underlying process through which normal cells don't die like they're supposed to and become cancer cells. And there are two basic reasons for that. One is that these cells are exposed to toxins that lead them to go astray and become cancer cells. The other is that under the normal dying of cells, they become so clever that they can evade the immune system. In both cases, the issue is strengthening the immune system. So the treatment of cancer involves really two things. One is killing cancer cells, and the other is preventing and stopping the process that forms the cancer cells, namely neoplasia. And so my research uncovered a wealth of information that was really surprising to me. There are many clinical studies that have been carried out, and many laboratory studies and studies on cancer cells themselves that demonstrate that the immunotherapy and nutritional therapy play a vital role in the treatment of cancer. So what I've developed with the help of other oncologists is what's called a complementary protocol, which means that along with conventional treatment, you take a variety of agents, which I will go into in detail later on, and I've called these a complementary cancer treatment protocol because they enhance the effectiveness of conventional treatment and also can reduce the side effects of conventional treatment. The other point I'd like to make is this, that no doctor has the time, I certainly didn't during my clinical practice, to learn everything I could about the particular disease or condition that a patient has. And so the title of my book is The Cancer Solution, not meaning that we're cured for cancer immediately, but the cancer solution is to take charge of your life with cancer, learn everything that you can about it, and you can help your doctors. In fact, the American Medical Association and other physicians' organizations today advocate that patients take responsibility for their own health and the treatment of their diseases or disabilities. So the bottom line is that my book, The Cancer Solution, Taking Charge of Your Life with Cancer, and website, which is thecancersolution.net. And in that website, I have updated the elements that are in my book. What I plan to do is continue my research and build upon the base that's in my book through this website that will bring to the attention of people with cancer and their loved ones and healthcare professionals the latest information that has been clinically demonstrated. But I'd like to emphasize this. Because cancer is such a frightening disease and the treatment of cancer now is measured more in terms of years of survival than cure, although there are some people who do sustain really long-lasting remissions. But I would hesitate to ever use the word cure, and that the underlying process, again, isn't the existence of cancer cells. It's that process of neoplasia that can come back again, even after years of remission. My own wife had 34 years of remission between the two bouts of cancer of the breast that she had. The last bout was a fatal one for her. So what I would like to do is get across to the public in general, because one in three of us will have cancer, and it will end our lives. And so what I would like to do is urge people to, number one, take charge of their health, and if they have cancer, take charge of their cancer treatment, and at the same time become advocates for improving cancer treatment and research. And the last point I'd like to make is this, that billions of dollars have been spent on cancer research. In fact, turning out a new form of chemotherapy can cost millions of dollars. And this is why chemotherapy costs between $6,000 and $12,000 a month. So incidentally, this is one reason for the general public to be concerned about this, because healthcare costs in this particular area are exceedingly high. So I'm urging patients and loved ones and the general public to advocate for increased funding. Unfortunately, President Obama has put this out as a priority recently, and Vice President Biden is working on this. And the important element there is not continuing to do research and treatment on the conventional treatments, but to work on immunotherapy and to work on nutritional therapy that will enhance conventional therapy and that will also make conventional therapy less traumatic for the people experiencing it. So the last chapter in my book is devoted to becoming an advocate. Contact your congressional representatives. Let them know that this is vital, and also help them to understand that simply killing cancer cells in itself, although necessary, is not enough. We have to address in research and treatment the underlying disease, which is neoplasia.
Yes, I had interviewed Dr. John Boyk, who was a researcher at, I believe it was MD Anderson. He was a cancer researcher there, but he had a background in natural medicine. And he had a book called Natural Compounds in Cancer Care that outlined about, I think there were about seven or eight or maybe more steps that occurred with this neoplasia that you're talking about. And there's a lot of natural compounds that will block each step of this. And he outlined them in great detail. And he said, and I think you would agree, that the future of cancer care is to put multiple blocks in place so this process of neoplasia cannot get out of hand. Neoplasia is one response the body has to injury. Basically, you know, when you injure a body, it can scar, it can degenerate, it can produce neoplasia. Now, I think we need to do more basic research into what causes it to go down these three different pathways. Benign tumors can occur with injury too, but then what makes the neoplasia occur? So I think there's a lot of hope with natural medicine that because we can interfere with this process at multiple steps, that perhaps we can even prevent cancer before it forms, which, of course, is the ideal thing to do, because once cancer forms, it becomes a whole different ballgame. But in your book, you have outlined some of the very important metabolic characteristics of cancer. Would you like to go into what these are and how certain lifestyle and dietary changes can make it so cancer can't live as well?
Yes, what you said is entirely true. And I'd like to add that when we speak in terms of natural medicine, there is a field, naturopathy, of professionals who are working in this area. Mm-hmm. And also, unfortunately, there are many people who are not trained in that area and who have their own ulterior motives and are quacks, actually. So that one of the things that I had to go through in my research was sifting and winnowing all of the claims for cancer cures and so on, and put my finger on only those that were actually demonstrated to be effective. Now, if we look again at the metabolic factors that are involved in cancer, I think it's very important for us to understand that all of our cells in our body die and are replaced. In other words, cells divide and they over time die, as you can see that with your skin and other evidences of aging. And that particular process is called apoptosis. And that is the normal way for cells to live through their life and to die. Now, if something happens to the mitochondria in cells, which mitochondria have DNA just like the cell nucleus, there is a strong tendency for that cell to become aberrant. And so there are toxic materials in the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the food we eat. Parenthetically, I've become a vegetarian as a result of my research. And these factors can produce what we call free radicals or oxidative stress. And that process causes cells to go wild and go into this process, first of all, dysplasia. And as you mentioned, there are some tumors that are benign, and those are the products of dysplasia, and then possibly go on to neoplasia, which produces the cancer cells themselves. So if we could see cancer in the light that many researchers are right now, namely as a normal process gone astray, as a matter of fact, there's a lot of work going on right now on what's called embryogenesis. In other words, the way that embryos are formed, one cell becomes multiple cells, becomes an embryo. And there's evidence that that process is a process that underlies neoplasia and takes place in later life. But since it isn't governed, it goes into a nilly-willy kind of cancer direction. Mm-hmm. Now, right. This leads me to add an additional point, and that is people talk about a genetic factor in cancer, and yes, there is. There are some forms of cancer that are hereditary and that one can trace to genes. But research that's focused solely on cancer genes is not productive. And unfortunately, that's where much of the research has gone in recent decades. And the reason for this is that cancer cells change their genes. In other words, the definition of cancer is mutation or changing the nature of the DNA in the cell. So that you can find a chemotherapy, for example, that works with a certain genetic aspect of the cancer cell, but it only hits maybe 80-90%, or perhaps less. And that leaves cells that are moving in another direction and evade the chemotherapy. So this is the reason why chemotherapy in itself, although it can kill cancer cells, will not get them all, and why there is recurrence. And unless you're extremely fortunate, ultimately leads to a failure of the process. So the bottom line here, as you implied, is cancer actually is a metabolic disease. In fact, Thomas Seyfried has a book with that title, Cancer is a Metabolic Disease. And that metabolic disease, again, underlying cancer is neoplasia.
Right. Now, cancer cells have an anaerobic type metabolism compared to an aerobic metabolism in normal cells. And we can use that to our advantage in treating cancer. Would you like to maybe give a little history of who discovered that and how important it is?
Yes, as a matter of fact, our knowledge about what we're talking about now goes back to 1924. And at that time, the direction that we're talking about right now was clearly established by a biochemist in Germany. And in the 50s and 60s and 70s, there was a resurgence of interest in that. And that was eclipsed during the 80s, 90s, and this century by the focus on the genetic aspect of cancer. And so, as you point out, cancer cells actually are very demanding cells. They require a lot of glucose, and they can't stand oxygen. They really love to be in an environment in which there's low oxygen. So if you are overweight and have high blood sugar, and if you're sedentary and don't exercise, there isn't a lot of oxygen, this is an ideal climate for cancer cells to thrive in. So as you've implied, there is a form of treatment that actually does kill the cancer cells themselves. The focus really isn't on strengthening the immune system. Mm-hmm. And that is a combination of what's called a ketogenic diet and increasing the oxygen in the body. And in Hungary, that is one of the active forms of cancer treatment that's being used successfully. Mm-hmm. And what this means then is you go on a low-carb diet, so the blood sugar goes way down, and you can have all the fat you want. And the main thing is low blood glucose. And if you do that, then the fat and even the carbohydrates, if they're in low quantity, can be used by the normal cells, the ketone bodies that are produced mm-hmm. by fats and so on, are good fuel. Just as good as glucose for normal cells, but they are deadly for cancer cells. So one prong of this dietary approach is reducing carbs and blood glucose, increasing mm-hmm. ketone bodies and having what's called, using what's called a ketogenic diet. And the other is, as you've implied, increasing the oxygen in the body. And of course, that means exercise, but it also can be done through the use of what's called cell food, C-E-L-L-F-O-O-D, which is a proprietary preparation, but it does very effectively increase the cellular oxygen in the body. And it also decreases the acidity of the body. And this leads to a third consideration that is in the same ballpark, and that is that an acidic body is an ideal body for cancer cells. And this is why testing your blood or urine pH, which reflects the acidity of the body, is important. The ideal circumstance for normal cells is a pH of what's called 6.8 to 7.4, which is toward the alkaline side. Mm-hmm. And if the blood level and cellular level of the body is acidic with a low pH, then cancer cells thrive in this. So the bottom line here is that this kind of nutrition, which is simply a ketogenic diet, increasing the oxygen in the blood and decreasing the acidity, is not only going to retard the growth, if not kill, cancer cells, but it's also going to prevent the process of neoplasia from forming them in the first place.
Right. We use alkaline water. There's plenty of alkaline water machines out there, but one of the cheapest things is an alkaline water tube and distilled water. It'll take the pH up to about 11. If you drink that water and then check your urine pH, if it's still acidic, there's something called buffer pH, which is a buffered solution. You know, some people are doing baking soda, but that can be a problem because there's too much sodium. You can get high blood pressure. But this is a buffered alkaline solution in a pill that you can adjust and then check your pH. And it is ideal, like you said, to have a pH between 7 and 7.5. And I just want to mention two other things that people can consider. There's actually an exercise program you can do while you're breathing oxygen. And I don't remember the name of it, but I've interviewed the people that developed it. And if you do the exercise program, which is not a real strenuous exercise, it's kind of a moderate exercise, so, you know, cancer patients usually can do it if they're not too far into the disease, and breathe the oxygen, then they get really high levels of oxygen in the blood. And I think the cell food's a great way to do it as well. I've been familiar with that therapy as well. And then some integrative doctors are using insulin potentiation therapy, where they give insulin to lower the blood sugar, and then they give a small amount of chemotherapy, and the lowered blood sugar pushes the chemo preferentially into the cancer cells. And so you get more bang for your buck in terms of killing the cancer cells, but not damaging normal cells. So that's something that many of my patients do, is this insulin potentiation therapy.
You just put your finger on a very important point, and that is that chemotherapy affects not only cancer cells, but other growing cells.
Yes.
And this is why the therapies that we've been talking about right now are of great appeal, because they only affect the cancer cells.
Right. And that's what you have to do. I mean, you have to target what you want to treat, but not cause so many side effects, because the treatment is targeting normal cells. But really, you know, in terms of a permanent solution for cancer, I'm of the belief that it is better to concentrate on raising the energy in the organ and in the individual through diet, through living foods, through, you know, exercise, through all of the things that you were talking about, alkalinity, low sugar. If you raise the energy of these organs, and I think eventually we'll have other ways to do that that don't require drugs but are more field effects, that we will be able to stop neoplasia because, I think that when we learn more about what neoplasia is, I think it's a response to things that lower the energy, whether it be radiation, you know, toxic chemicals, geopathic stress, emotional states might be important for very precipitously lowering the energy in an organ. So all of these things are treatable, you know, because if you can identify what puts the organ at risk for neoplasia, you can reverse that specifically.
You make an excellent point. And the mitochondria are the energy engines of cells. And as I indicated earlier, the evidence is pointing very clearly at dysfunction of mitochondria. They're
right.
Not producing the energy in a normal way. And this is, as research is progressing in this area, becoming much more clear and substantiates the point that you're making.
Yeah, I mean, the mitochondria are responsible. They are the energy machines within the cell. And when I say cancer occurs in organs with lowered energy, that very well might be mediated by mitochondrial damage or dysfunction. I mean, that's because the whole energy of the organ is down. It reverts to anaerobic metabolism, and then that is involved specifically with neoplasia. So, and we also have to understand that you know, medicine has this thing that we really need to emphasize. It says, first, do no harm. And I'm sure in your research you found that medical radiation, especially the new digital diagnostic devices, CAT scans, digital mammograms, and whatever, these put a lot of radiation into the tissue. And there is an article in the peer-reviewed literature in radiology that shows that if somebody has a silicone breast implant and gets a normal digital mammogram, they actually get an overdose of radiation to the breast tissue because some of it reflects off the implant into the tissue. But to date, I've yet to find a radiologist that understands this. So, you know, we have a responsibility, especially when we figure this stuff out, to get that information out. I mean, every woman with a silicone implant should be getting a lower dose with these mammograms, but that's not happening. So, you know, and doctors that over-order CAT scans and other diagnostic tests that actually increase the risk of cancer, this needs to be addressed. And actually it is, I think the World Health Organization is addressing this.
Yes, in my book I go into more detail about this, and the American Society of Radiology actually has standards, and they urge people to keep a record of their radiation-based imaging, CAT scans.
Right.
This does not apply to MRIs, but it applies to CAT scans and regular X-ray. And so there is an unfortunate trend in oncology to do repeated CAT scans that are producing radiation that actually can cause cancer, to follow the progress of cancer. So that if, for example, you have a CAT scan every 6 months, something of that nature, you are actually introducing more radiation that aggravates the cancer as you are following the progress or lack of progress of the cancer. So I would emphasize again for everyone that if you have normal X-rays or CAT scans, that you keep a record of this so that you don't exceed the national recommendations and the World Health Organization recommendations. And they're not very clear as to how frequently, you need to have this, but once a year is considered to be too much. And so this means that one of the processes that we use to diagnose and follow cancer actually aggravates the process of cancer development.
Yeah, and I'd like to take this opportunity. I gave a lecture at the Truth Convention on the FDA, oversight of everything except for drugs. So there's a whole bunch of things like radiation devices, implants, skincare products, all the different things that aren't drugs. And one of the things that I want to let the listening audience know that they can do to protect themselves is every time you go through that machine, I'm not talking about the metal detector machines, I'm talking about the ones where you have to raise your arms, don't do that. Go ahead and have a pat down. There is no reason for any extra radiation in your life. The pat down takes a little longer, but if you're not late for your flight, go ahead and have the pat down. I always just say I have an immune problem, which I do because of the silicone toxicity. And they're fine. You know, they understand that people don't want to go through that machine. And especially if you're flying frequently, and I'm saying this because I read the letters to the president that were written by a group of radiologists and doctors warning the administration against putting these in service, the scientific stuff. So I'm not saying it just on a belief, my own personal belief system. This is based on the belief systems of experts that wrote letters and cited studies that were then ignored when TSA put these into place.
Excellent point. This brings out again how cancer can be viewed as a product of civilization and technology,
right,
with all the toxins that we have, and now more recently with the X-ray or radiation process you go through to enter an airplane.
And then electromagnetic fields need to be considered as well. There's a great deal of evidence. I interviewed Dr. Carlo, who did $20 million worth of research for the cell phone companies and found that the mechanism of action of neuroepithelial malignancies is actually free radicals. And what's interesting is if you take melatonin, say you use your cell phone up near your head, which I don't recommend, but say you do, there's a lot of evidence that taking melatonin a night, 6 milligrams of melatonin, is sufficient to undo the free radicals that build up. So there's actually 3 kind of cancers that Dr. Carlo found were aggravated by cell phone use near the head, and that was parotid tumors of the 8th cranial nerve, which are usually benign, eye tumors, which can be malignant, especially if there's a mole or a nevus in the retina that can then turn into cancer, and then neuroepithelial malignancies within the brain. And I believe there's 7 or 8 class action lawsuits right now against cell phone companies for failing to provide adequate protection on the cell phone. And children are actually more prone than adults are for these problems. So again, it's a situation where you need to educate yourself. There are devices. Dr. Norm Shealy recommends a device. He's done extensive testing of these devices. He recommends a little Q-link that can go on your cell phone and disrupt this so that it's not so dangerous. But really, I think using the speakerphone, using devices that keep the phone away from your head, and for God's sake, don't store your cell phone in your bra or in your pocket next to an organ, like for men, next to their gonads, women on their breasts. Just be very, very aware that storing your cell phone in the same location on your body, especially near organs, can lead to problems. So, That's one thing that we need to...
The point that you're making right now is one that 10 years from now we'll know for sure. In other words, there are an increasing number of experiences that we're having with modern technology that clearly are destructive, and people wait for scientific studies, placebo controls, and so on. But we don't need to wait for those things. What you're saying right now, we can do now.
It's just common sense. You know, you just don't want that signal to be, you know, bathing an organ. I mean, you may not be susceptible to it. You know, you may have the genetics that protect you, but you may not. And I have so many patients that develop cancer right where they were storing the cell phone. I had a gentleman develop a melanoma right over where he stored the cell phone on his leg. And he was a black gentleman. And as you know, blacks rarely get melanoma. And he knew, I mean, he came in saying that the cell phone, he thought that the cell phone radiation of, or electromagnetic was responsible for it. And, you know, there's just a lot of the patients, I've had a woman who stored her cell phone in her bra come in with breast cancer right in the area that the cell phone was stored. I've had patients with lymphoma who said that they did a lot of consulting with the cell phone right on their chest. You know, they just put it there and talk for long periods of time, and then they develop lymphoma right in that area. So, you know, it might be having nothing to do with it, but many of my patients link the position of the cell phone to the subsequent cancer. And I don't have that big a practice, you know. I'm not seeing that many cancer patients. So you can imagine, you know, someone who's seeing them all the time, what they might be hearing from the patient.
Yes.
So would you like to give your contact information one more time and tell the listening audience a little bit about what's on your website?
Yes, the website is thecancersolution.net. And the website goes into the development of newer modalities that are coming to my attention. And it also updates myself and the reader, of course, to organizations that are becoming more active. There are support organizations that can be very helpful in terms of bringing you in with other people so that you can trade notions and ideas. And the website also has a link to a petition that was developed by 118 oncologists who are protesting the high costs of chemotherapy. This leads me to address a situation that is there and is one that we must take into consideration. And that is that the treatment of cancer really can be called an industry in the sense that there are doctors who specialize in the disease, oncology. We don't have people specializing in HIV or polio or other diseases like that. But we do have a medical specialty that's devoted to the treatment of cancer, and oncologists would be really much better served by treatments that produced positive results, so that rather than presiding over the decline of patients as they succumb to cancer, they would be putting them into remission. So the oncologists will always be needed because cancer, again, is not going to disappear. But the second thing is that hospitals also have cancer centers, and these are centers that generate very significant income. And so if there was to be a decrease in cancer, it would have an impact. I met with the president of a hospital was talking about my book. And the response that I received really surprised me in one way. It didn't in another way. But she really was not interested in what I was talking about because she said, we're going to be building now a new cancer center. So there's that second level of economic, if you will, dependency upon the existence of cancer. But thirdly, of course, the manufacturers of these very costly chemotherapeutic agents would not exist if we did not have cancer, and certainly would be threatened by a decrease in the usage of it. And unfortunately, this is something that in medicine, both you and I are aware of, and that is there are economic factors that play a role in the practice of medicine and in healthcare. And so, unfortunately, and this is why I wrote this book, actually, in the subtitle, Taking Charge of Your Life with Cancer, you really got to look at the big picture here and not only do everything you can to help yourself, but to help the field by focusing research and treatment on the prevention of cancer and on methods that will reduce cancer and actually be efficacious without all the expense that's involved. One of the things that I personally have encountered, and as I indicated earlier, three members of my family had cancer, and I have been in the position of having to subsidize the treatment of one of my offspring because the cost of chemotherapy is so high that he, being retired and having this disease, needs help to pay for the treatment.
Right. Yeah, there's no question that it's a multi-billion dollar industry. I think the last figure I heard was $18 billion a year in the U.S. alone. And I do want to mention that in Europe, things are a little bit different. Cancer is considered more of a chronic disease rather than a acute disease. And some of the treatment methods are different. Like a lot of the doctors will encourage people to make sure they have dental health, because when you don't have dental health, your immune system is spending a lot of its time fighting that, you know, and getting the mercury out. They tend not to use chemotherapy for certain types of cancer that are not as successful with it, and they use more natural methods that we've talked about today. And cancer can be more of a chronic disease once that approach is taken.
The situation is one that really demands the attention of the public. Cancer is a terrible condition. And we can do much better in approaching it and managing it. The unfortunate fact is it's going to take pressure from the public and pressure from patients who take responsibility for their lives to produce the kind of change that we need. Or turning it around the other way, the system itself is not set up in such a way that there's an incentive to reduce the incidence and prevalence of cancer. And that reminds me of one simple thing that an MD Anderson researcher, in fact, the head of research at MD Anderson, has demonstrated to be clinically true and statistically true in terms of general populations. And that is the use of curcumin, which is in turmeric, which is in curry.
Right.
It retards the growth of cancer cells. In fact, it can stop the process of neoplasia. And this has been demonstrated in animals, cells, and human beings, in vitro and in vivo. And it also is reflected in the fact that India has one-third the incidence of cancer compared to right. the United States. So there's a simple thing, namely curcumin, which is something that actually I take along with antioxidants to prevent cancer.
Right.
And it's very simple.
Prevention of cancer is really important. Yeah, prevention is something we can all do. There are two products with curcumin. Of course, dietary curcumin is easy to do, but if you want a little bit more higher blood levels, there's a product called Curcumin SR by Quality of Life Laboratories, and then a lipospheric curcumin that anything that's lipospheric gets absorbed very, very well, and you can almost get IV levels in the blood. So we put patients on these two products that get very high levels of curcumin, and hopefully will decrease neoplasia if they're prone to it. Now, you have some other recommendations within your complementary cancer treatment protocol that I'd like to go over. Almost everybody probably from the age 30 on should be on intermittent milk thistle or silymarin as a liver detox agent just because of the toxins we're exposed to on a daily basis. That's something that you can do to help your liver process toxic chemicals so that they don't build up and cause neoplasia.
Yes, milk thistle is one. The other ingredients of the complementary protocol that I have put together all in one place are the ketogenic diet, the cell food, as we've mentioned, curcumin, as we've mentioned, and in a special form, as you pointed out, and curamet also is another one that increases the absorption, milk thistle, silymarin, Empower, which is AHCC. Actually is an immune system modulator that is used very extensively in China and effectively in the treatment of cancer. Vitamin D3 in 4,000 to 6,000, even possibly 8,000 international units. And aspirin, because, as you mentioned earlier, the inflammation that's involved can be useful at low dose for the prevention of cancer and also heart disease, although there may be some questions about that that have been raised recently. And the other body of information and technology and so on relates to, as you pointed out earlier, stress relieving opportunities. And here, yoga, meditation, exercise, anything that reduces stress.
Yeah, Tai Chi, yoga, any of that. Yeah.
Yes, and this brings out something that we alluded to earlier, and that is that cancer is very stressful in itself, just having cancer, going through the treatment. Mm-hmm. And that stress inhibits the immune system.
Right.
So this is one of the other points. I end the book with this kind of a statement that if you can take charge of your life with cancer and be satisfied that you're doing everything that you can and the doctors are doing everything they can, you have empowered yourself. And you can stand back, so to speak, from the point of view of fear, helplessness, and so on. You can feel empowered that you're doing everything that you can. And if you combine that with these stress-relieving technologies, that in itself can not only make cancer treatment more effectively, but for all of us, prevent cancer.
Right. I want to mention that not everybody can take aspirin. You know, some people have sensitive stomachs. The mucosal lining is, you know, is not able to do that. But there is something used extensively in Japan called natokinase, which will thin the blood without affecting the gastric mucosa or affecting the kidneys. And you can determine your optimal dose of that. Now, just like aspirin, if you're on natokinase, you need to stop it 3 weeks prior to surgery and 3 weeks after. I had a small mole removal when I was on natokinase, and I didn't bleed during surgery, but after surgery, I developed quite a bruise. So I proved that to myself. I kind of knew it, but I didn't know that it really, really needed to be stopped. So natokinase can be substituted for aspirin. It's a little more expensive, but like I said, there's less. It'll thin the blood. It's anti-inflammatory. It has some benefits that you can take advantage of if aspirin is not able to be taken. And I do want to mention one other thing. Because the emotional toll is so high when we hold grudges and energy against certain situations and people, like the lack of forgiveness, really will affect the immune system. There's a great deal of research in the spiritual literature that forgiveness, which is releasing an energy within you, not pardoning somebody, which is a Greek term, but if you're able to release the energy within you for certain situations, that your immune system comes up a great deal. So there's a number of spiritual teachers out there that concentrate on forgiveness, and I happen to use Michael Rice's No-Fault Forgiveness Worksheet for my cancer patients, because a stressful situation involving relationships often has occurred within 6 months to a year of the cancer occurring, and especially in some cancers like kidney cancer and breast cancer. So that is important to address, because in my opinion, that may be the main reason the energy in the organ dropped, was that lack of forgiveness.
Your point is well taken, that to the extent that we're living with anxiety and stress, and particularly what you're talking about now, which actually has political implications in that, as we see, there's a lot of polarization and anger in the public today.
There
about
is.
Presidential candidates, things of that nature. And this level of anger that is sort of permeating our society because of the polarization of ideologies is not helping any of us. So one of the things that happens when you forgive or get into stress-relieving activities is that you let go. So rather than being all bound up inside, you relax. And that
right.
in itself is manna for the immune system.
And you know that you've done it successfully whenever you think of that situation again or something reminds you of it, you don't get that feeling in your stomach, you know, that tightness or that muscle tension. Because you have a physiologic reaction, a flight or fight reaction. And actually, Dr. Norm Shealy has demonstrated that when you have that reaction, your DHEA levels plummet, and you also put out epinephrine, norepinephrine, and cortisol. And we know that cortisol depresses the immune system. So, you know, you can tie everything back to immune problems if you are not emotionally healthy.
Yes.
That's called psychoneuroimmunology, and I'm sure you've looked into that in terms of the probably in psychiatry as well as applies to cancer. It's a very interesting field.
Yes, there's a sound neuroscientific basis for this, yes.
Right. Well, we're coming up on the end of our hour. I want to congratulate you for writing this book. I think it's one that is well-researched and has great ideas and a plan of action, which I think, you know, whenever you write a book challenging the status quo, a plan of action is actually very important, because you just don't want to stir people up and then have nothing that they can do about it. So thank you for writing it, and we we applaud you for the 2 years that you spent researching it.
And thank you for this opportunity.
Well, we've been interviewing Dr. Jack Westman. His book, The Cancer Solution, Taking Charge of Your Life with Cancer, is a very important book for caretakers and any people with cancer. And actually, because cancer is going to strike one in three of us, and there's so much preventative stuff in here, I'd suggest anybody read it, because if you modify his program, I believe that you'll go a long way to preventing cancer. Thank you very much, Dr. Westman. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Please join us next week.